This is Ian Gregg reporting for CIFA Radio's Due North on 88.7 FM. This initiative is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada through the Local Journalism Initiatives Program. Find our news stories online at frequencynews.ca or cfur.ca. So, in part one of two, in our conversation with Mr. John A. Brink, experienced local forestry entrepreneur, he reviewed some history and context ranging from the 50s, even reaching into the 80s, exploring the ins and outs of our region's forestry industry and a bit beyond. Now in part two, we haul our bunk of information through the continual consolidation of industry and into the more contemporary section of forest industry history. Pulp mill technology, regulations, pine beetle, trade disputes, and more. Let us re-enter the forest in part two of two, walking into that thicket of consolidation once more, eventually pulling into the cut block, where Mr. Brink lays out his assessment of our regional forestry industry's current situation and what the near future may hold.
Consolidation became more and more of an issue, more and more and more and more, even to the extent that in 1955, H.R. McMillan, who was the first provincial forester, suggested that the consolidation of lumber manufacturing would dominate the industry, and at some point, likely, it would be not to the benefit of the province and the crown. That's where we are today, obviously. That was comments that he made at the time of the Sloan Commission hearing in 1955.
Wow. He saw the writing on the wall far before it happened. There you go.
So, and he was referring to the coast and obviously gradually as we went into the interior. Right. From there on forward, it consolidated more and more and more to where probably the next significant thing that happened is that we had the pine beetle infestation in Tweedsmuir Park. It started, but they couldn't do much about it because it was a park, therefore it could not be dealt with or harvested, and it spread subsequently throughout all of the interior of the province. So more than a billion cubic meters was needed to be harvested so they didn't rot. So put that into perspective. The annual allowable cut normally in the province of British Columbia is about 60 million cubic meters annually. And so it would be 16 times the annual allowable cut of the amount of pine beetle that was harvested. Very cheap, but to capture as much of the economic value as possible. That's what happened.
To elaborate, the BC forestry industry, which is permitted to harvest a certain volume of timber each year, measured in cubic meters, had the parameters of its limitations expanded as a result of this pine beetle infestation event. That is not to say harvesting prior to this time was insignificant, with a peak harvest of nearly 90 million cubic meters recorded in 1987, but this infestation, noticed in 1993, had quite an impact, with the worst year recorded in 2005, with approximately 140 million cubic meters of pine being attacked by the beetle, resulting in increased AACs from 2001 to 2014, leading to a peak annual allowable cut of 87.3 million cubic meters in 2007. Those increases in annual allowable cut were in response to the approximately 731 million at the time predicted to be over a billion cubic meters of merchantable pine volume being killed. But while we're on the subject of billions, were a billion cubic meters of timber actually harvested in that time period? According to a BC government report entitled Trends in Timber Harvest in BC, published in 2023, there was an average annual harvest of 60 million cubic meters per year between 2003 and 2023. If you multiply that 60 million by 20 years, the result is 1.2 billion cubic meters. I'm not a billionaire and you probably aren't either, so a billion is pretty difficult to conceptualize. If you are a billionaire, please spend the next 20 seconds donating to local journalism. We've made it very easy. A million grains of sand can fit into a coffee cup. Well, a billion grains of sand can fill an industrial dump truck. Again, to attempt to visualize this number, a standard refrigerator is about a cubic meter. For the billionaires still listening, a refrigerator is a device we, in lower income brackets, use to keep your food cold in to prevent it from spoiling. Where could you fit a billion refrigerators? That volume works out to a giant cube that's a kilometer tall and a kilometer wide on every side. If you were to liquefy that cube and spread it out over a city like Vancouver or Calgary, it could form a blanket of water about a meter and a half or 5 feet deep, covering the entire downtown core. In other words, a billion is a lot of just about anything. Many BC residents are well aware that when the pine beetle epidemic swept through the province, went further north and further into Western Canada, decisions were made that allowed for more harvesting. But the scale of harvesting that Mr. Brink is describing remains difficult to consider. To conceptualize this in perhaps a more familiar way, let's think of a B-train tractor trailer setup, or a super B-train, where you've got your big freight-hauling truck pulling two connected trailers, the type of setup that has a fifth wheel hitch built in to the end of the first trailer so it can couple on another trailer, where the logs are all packed in together, comfy cozy, between sets of what look like giant blunted meat forks. You see them coming out of the forestry roads all the time and then onto the highway, chugging down the road. They typically haul between 55 and 65 cubic meters. For the following calculations, I'll assume that every truck is hauling 60 cubic meters for the sake of simplicity. Let's say on a given year, there's an annual allowable cut of 50 million cubic meters. That works out to just over 830,000 fully loaded B-trains coming out of the forest. If we were to consider the roughly estimated harvest of 1.2 billion cubic meters accumulated over a 20-year period, that would amount to about 16.5 million Super B loads pulled around the province of BC. If you thought the road was kind of busy in that era, you were probably onto something. A billion is a big number. When things are that big, they tend to have an impact, as Mr. Brink describes.
But it did a number of things. It put the cost down. It pushed up the manufacturing volumes. If you look at the volumes, look at from 2000 all the way up to 2015, 16, 17. And the volume really pushed up high. And then, you know, the industry is cyclical. You know, so prices went down and all of that. And so the other part that happened again in forest policy is that, in my opinion, we are not good stewards of the resource. We are immensely blessed in this province by available fiber. Even now, every 5 years we do an analysis of how much of the annual allowable cut could potentially be available to us. Even now, it is in excess. It wasn't all the way through in the pine beetle area. It was below that. But so of all the volume available, and forest policy is critical to this, I don't want to really go into politics other than to say that the NDP has been government for the last 10 years. It is thought, and I agree with that, that forest policy has not been well understood by them, and the policies have not been coherent with that. So that then being said, the last analysis that was done, I believe last year, 2025, analysis was that there is still the annual allowable cut is now still 60 million or in excess of 60 million cubic meters. Now, for the people watching us that may not be familiar with the annual allowable cut is that how do you maintain the level of the annual allowable cut? Obviously, the pine beetle epidemic brought down the volume and subsequently the annual allowable cut, although it pushed it up initially that they harvested. But even now still, we are now at 60 million cubic meters annually. And the way it is calculated is basically saying, how do we maintain the volume? How much can we harvest and replant, taking into account all the things, including wildfires and pandemics of some sort or another, so that we maintain the volumes? So where we are now at 60 million cubic meters, then the other part about it is policy. Obviously, the other part that happened to 10-year holders, and there are a number of 10-years.
Key terminology, tenure holder. So you, of course, remember the AAC, or allowable annual cut. Well, a tenure holder in BC is an individual or company or community that holds a legal agreement with a provincial government granting specific rights to use or develop public crown land. Holding tenure doesn't mean you own the land. No, no. It gives the holder permission to use the land or resources under various rules and regulations for a set period. Rules and regulations like allowable annual cut regulations. If you are a tenure holder, you could be a rancher, an oil and gas company, you could be operating a ski resort, or you could have an interest in harvesting timber, among other things. Based on the use of that public land, a tenure holder typically pays rent or taxes or stumpage fees. Forest tenures are the agreement between a company, a community, or an individual and the BC government that grant the rights and outline the conditions through various licenses and permits under which timber is harvested from provincial land. Taking care of your new tenure is more complicated than taking care of your new Tamagotchi pal, but you can find out more, of course, by searching for the BC government document Managing Your New Timber Tenure in British Columbia.pdf. If you've ever printed off a Christmas tree permit, that is actually a form of a timber tenure. Some examples of tenure holders include, but are not limited to, woodlot licenses, which are typically fairly small and managed by individuals or families on public and private land, First Nations woodland licenses, which are long-term tenures designed to support Indigenous economic participation and traditional land use, community forest agreements, which are area-based licenses held by local governments or communities to manage local forests, forest licenses, which are agreements to harvest a set volume of timber within a wider area, which is typical of the scale of forestry in which we are talking about in this segment, and also tree farm licenses, large area-based tenures granting long-term management and harvesting rights over specific regions. Timber and forest tenures can be transferred, sold, assigned, or conveyed, but this does require notice and approval from the Ministry of Forests. Agreements issued under Section 12 of the Forest Act can also be surrendered. The process of getting tenureship is outlined, but it's not necessarily easy. In fact, the process is known to be complex, quite competitive, and has been indicated by the description so far, the process is strictly regulated. Historically, this process probably wasn't easy at any point, but as Mr. Brink is about to outline from his perspective, there are more challenges now than there have been in the past.
And there are a number of tenures that are being dominated still by the larger companies. And give you an example, let's just look at where we are with the changes that have taken place. UNDRIP, by discussion in the United Nations as to access of the First Nations in particular, of having access to their resources or their traditional lands, passed a notion that would protect First Nations interests. And it is called or commonly known as UNDRIP. And they likely will have the objective to control 20 million cubic meters annually. But also, they are directly involved in protecting the interest of First Nations and all the other resources they depend on. So that is the one issue. And the other issue is that likely because of pine beetle pandemic, pushing the volumes up so high that the volumes we pushed into the United States, because that's very short-sighted, our virtually only market, it put in difficulty a lot of the U.S. producers that started lobbying very, very heavily against using volume controls, in particular, coming in from Canada into the United States through the U.S. Softwood Lumber Coalition. So the way to do that for them was through using duties. And it started out as 7-8%, then it became 12, then it became 15, then it became 25, then it became 35. Now it is 45.16%. Wow. That's for lumber manufacturers.
That
including value-added manufacturers.
And that range from roughly, I don't know, the early 2000s into present day. Is that
actually, it started in 1982.
Oh, 1982.
If you say softwood lumber duties, go to Google and it will say it started. Lumber 1 was known in 1982. So we can spend a whole hour talking about what it is. But basically, it is an issue of control of their market. They are very effective and controlling it. Under the current government in the United States, under the umbrella of Trump, you know, they have pushed it up higher and higher. In fact, actually, as now looking at the news media, that on the 19th, there will be another announcement in regards to another potential 50% duties being applied, or tariffs being applied, to other products that have an element of lumber or fiber involvement. Could be furniture, could be kitchen cabinets, and all of those things. So we'll hear about that on the 19th. And that would then add another 50%.
And hear about it? We did, as did the entire continent. While the announcement from the U.S. was delayed until August 22nd, the three presidential proclamations that U.S. President Donald Trump signed on July 20th, 2026, that threatened additional 50% tariffs stacked on top of some pre-existing ones, did ultimately come into effect following a breakdown between Canada-U.S. trade docs, which occurred on Friday, August 21st, 2026. The related proclamations were the Motor Vehicles Proclamation, the Dairy Proclamation, and the Alcohol Proclamation. You may think they would be unrelated, but Canadian wood products fell under the Motor Vehicles Proclamation and the Alcohol Proclamation. Products subject to tariffs under the Motor Vehicles Proclamation do include wood and paper products such as pulp, stationery, boxes, labels, and envelopes, while under the Alcohol Proclamation, wooden cutting boards and other wooden kitchenware are affected. As of September 1st, it would appear that specifically structural dimensional lumber, such as what Brink Forest Products produces, are not additionally tariffed. But the situation is changing rapidly, and the pre-existing tariffs and duties have not been removed.
So where are we then today? So in order for us to be viable, we have to know there is a market for the products. At 45.16%, there is no one in the forest industry is making any money. Cannot be done. And then add to that concerns about UNDRIP and the control of First Nations, and I'm not against that, but, you know, at the end of the day, there has to be viability, and we still have to attract entrepreneurship, crazy guys like me, lay awake all night long with an idea, then we have an idea, we will attract capital, and then from there on in, capital will come here, seeing an opportunity, blah, blah, blah. That's the way it goes. Right now, what is lacking is entrepreneurship that can show viability to attract capital. Capital that is here substantially have left or are in the process of leaving. So what we have now is all the larger companies that we used to know, Canfor, Best Fraser, Interfor, and I can just go on and on and on, have left the province or in the process of leaving. So there used to be 120 sawmills in BC. Now we have less than 60. And then usually the best way to figure it out is that for every three sawmills, we can justify for fiber and a pulp mill. And so probably 15 to 20 pulp mills have shut down. And another announcement was here in Quesnel, a pulp mill being reduced, obviously down in Prince George, several of them here. And there probably is another two or three that will go down, in my opinion. As sawmills go down, and we have lost about 60, 50% of them here and in other places. Probably another three or four will go down. If you look at Northwood Pulp, it had about 300 people involved, but the multiplier in jobs is for every direct job, we have another three indirect. So the amount of jobs affected in our community is probably 1,200. Brink Forsprax, that has been a secondary manufacturer, we have no timber. And the justification for the Americans is that the reason for duties, and to a certain extent tariffs, is that our timber, which is controlled by the Crown, mainly 97% is controlled by the Crown, is being subsidized. And so on the basis of that, the duties. Brink has no timber. We are a secondary manufacturer. We get no handouts, no subsidies. But still we're being caught into the duty cycle. So what does it mean to Brink? I'm the sole owner of all my companies. We have paid in duties mainly, in tariffs to a certain extent, over $100 million since 2017. That means $1 million a month, or $10 to $12 million a year. And that's what we still do today. And when we were initially operating, is they say, what do we do with the forest? Okay, so John, what then do we do? I did a podcast here 2 weeks ago with the Minister of Forest on the Brink with John A. Brink. So, and I commend the Honorable Ravi Pama for wanting to be on my podcast without preconditions. And as you now already know, I'm well informed. And I'm not shy about facts or issue. So where do we go from here? That obviously capital is leaving. Most of the mills have been shut down. But I say now around northern BC, if I go to Fort Nelson, Fort St. John, Chetwynd, McKenzie, Bear Lake, Fraser Lake, Vanderhoof, Houston, I can go on and on and on and on. It's a graveyard of sawmills. Will it change? No. And then who controls the tenure in the timber? With all due respect to my friend Jimmy Patterson, who owns the Patterson Group of Companies, Jimmy Patterson controls 52% of Canfor, whatever they have left here, including the pulp mills, and they control 14% or 13% of West Fraser. Between those two companies, and bringing us back to how much of the AAC now, 60 million cubic meters, is available to investors that have sawmills. Because of all the issues, the political ones, UNDRIP, all of the other things and duties, is that of the 60 million cubic meters available, the objective of government is to try to make available 45 million cubic meters annually. They have not been successful in doing that. In fact, in 2026, the volume was about 26 million cubic meters. That then being said, and all those other sawmills being taken down and sold for scrap, are we going to build a new sawmill? No. Who would and why? And what does a new sawmill cost today? At least $250 million. So if you want to attract capital, it doesn't take the $200 study to suggest the opportunity. It is obvious that capital is not ready to come back to BC in the forest industry. Where do we go from here?
It doesn't sound, the picture you're painting doesn't sound like there's a lot of room to breathe for other competition to move in and do something different.
So, but then we collectively, and I'm not a pessimist, although a reality has to be spoken, and that's what I'm doing, is then saying, where are the opportunities? What must we do first and foremost? We are all stakeholders, including First Nations. So we have to bring governments together, the federal government, the provincial government, the local, regional, and city governments, and UNDRIP together and saying, what are the objectives? Obviously, the objectives, first and foremost, should be now, since we're talking on the 12th of August, that the premier of the province of British Columbia has just announced a crisis mandate for this province of British Columbia on dealing with forest fires and wildfires, especially in the BC Southeast. So that's where our attention is now first. And then the next one will be, what do we do to protect us collectively from wildfires? And it would be a whole podcast to speak about that. I spoke with Minister of Forest about it 2 weeks ago on the issues that are challenging. The next one is then, with all this timber that we have, how do we attract capital? It's obvious that under the circumstances, we will not. So maybe the first thing to think about is that, how do we bring all our governments together, the federal government, the provincial government, the regional city governments, and then UNDRIP? I believe we have 204 or 206 First Nations, including, as we sit here, which is the traditional lands of the Kleinetsene, unsurrendered, and they are party to all of this as to where do we go from here. Now, the other part that you mentioned in your layout is that First Nations has acquired the timber or the manufacturing facility from Canfor and Vanderhoof.
That's right. Yeah, they all pooled the resources to purchase the Plateau Sawmill, closed by Canfor December 2024. It was purchased, I think, June 30th, 2026 here, earlier this summer.
The Four Nations, which purchased the vacant Plateau Sawmill, formerly owned by Canfor, along with a 1,070-acre multi-use industrial area now known as Nechaco Industrial Park, about 18 kilometers west of downtown Vanderhoof, are the Kleinetsene, Nadlewuten, Tsikas, and Stalaten. To be clear, this question is a hypothetical, and the group has not mentioned any public plans of reopening the sawmill at this point. We don't want to excite anyone unnecessarily.
If that partnership reopens the mill, and they do its best to source fiber and timber locally, I don't know, from your perspective, how similar or different would that setup be to the scene that you saw in the early 70s, where we had a lot of owner-operated enterprises operating locally?
These were organizations that started from the ground up at a skilled knowledge. With all due respect to my friends, First Nations, they have no knowledge of manufacturing. None. Zero. And so
These companies are new to this process of operating a sawmill.
Okay. What do we do now? You know, so you have to attract capital. In order to attract capital, you have to have a good history of knowledge and operational skills so you can project that you will have, through all the ups and downs, a viable company. Is that possible now? It isn't. Will First Nations at this point do that? I don't believe so. At some point, maybe in the next couple of generations, they have to first find entrepreneurship. I tried to acquire the Vanderhoof Mill. I tried to acquire the mill in Fort St. John. I tried to buy the one in Bear Lake. I tried to buy the one in Mackenzie. But Canfor was not interested in selling it at the time.
Right. By that token, though, would these four nations, in your perspective, be taking part in that act of entrepreneurship by purchasing that sawmill to reopen it? You think they'll be able to source expertise locally to get it going? There's probably capable hands in the area that could make this run.
Okay.
I don't know. What do you think?
Would you invest in it?
Why not?
Okay. So there you go.
My entire life savings? No. I wouldn't do that for anything, though, you know?
So what I'm saying, with all due respect, there has to be a viable opportunity. And this does not even come close to comparing to the mid-60s when timber was available in the province of British Columbia. And again, right, as I said earlier.
And this is probably the key difference, is that availability of the forest resources,
correct,
basically.
Is that it goes back to H.R. McMillan, that they say, as long as we have consolidation, and at some point that these companies that control all the tenure will decide that they don't intend to further invest, but still control the tenure, is not good for the communities or for investment in this amazing resource that we have here. So today, as I said, in 2025, although we have 60 million cubic meters available, we cannot get cutting permits because of the bureaucracy, because of UNDRIP or First Nations not necessarily wanting to cooperate, and then finding the capital to build new mills or to operate or buy the existing ones. They're not on the market, the existing ones. The First Nations bought the Vanderhoof Mill, as far as I know, for the purpose of redeveloping it into an industrial area, not as a sawmill. But if they want to, then they can try to do that.
But certainly challenges would be ahead of them, basically.
Yeah, big time. So that if they had available, you know, all the timber in 2025, the annual allowable cut was only 26 million cubic meters.
I neglected to confirm at the time, but I believe here that Mr. Brink is referring to the annual allowable cut apportioned in 2025 for the combined northern timber supply areas of the province, which ranges from about 22 to 28 million cubic meters based on my own calculations from data supplied by the Ministry of Forests, Lands, and Natural Resource Operations apportionment system.
The Patterson Group alone that owns 13%, 12% of West Fraser, 52% of Canfor, control 15 million cubic meters. So 50% of all the available tenure is controlled by people that do not invest here. So would I invest into a major operation? No. Will we find capital elsewhere? No. So what do we need to do? We have to change, make radical change to forest policy. We have to look at wildfires and managing the forest better than we have done so far. I'm not being critical of what it is, but that's what it is for global warming and all the other things. What else can we do? We have to ask ourselves, what are we leaving behind in the forest? And it'd be scary once we do the evaluation of what do we leave behind. And so we are in transition, but some difficult decisions have to be made. We live in the most favorable place from a market perspective in the world, right next to North America, China, Europe on the other side. We have this amazing, amazing country called Canada in North America, between Canada, the United States, Mexico, amazing, although there are political issues, but they all have time to pass. They will not last. And then we have all these resources, and then this amazing, amazing land called Canada, in particular BC. So I still, in all the time that I've been here, 62 years, built companies, many companies, is that every morning I get up at 5:30, even at 86 years old, always make my bed. I always think I'm late. And when I come outside, Ian, you know what I do for every morning? If there is 1,000 people around me, 5 or 10 or nobody, I say, I'm in paradise. And that's how I feel about it. It's a land of opportunity. But some serious decisions have to be made as to what do we do, what does it look like, and even First Nations, that we must be able to attract capital. We cannot attract capital. It starts with attracting entrepreneurship. Crazy guys like me, you know, saying, okay, I wonder if I take all these short little pieces, glue them together, and that creates a product or something like that.
And in your view, as far as coming to a solution that could benefit everybody, would it basically require everybody to come together and agree and compromise on a whole host of issues to collectively pursue something together in order to actually make these sorts of policy changes that could benefit everybody?
So what I hear you say, would it not be simply getting everybody come together and politicians? It's not realistic, and I say that respectful to you, Ian. It's because even First Nations can't agree on each other in their own organizations. So there is 204 or 206 First Nations. that all have different ideas and objectives. We got politicians here. NDP government has been in power for the last 10 years, you know, and a lot of people think there should be a change. You know, we see capital leaving their assets behind and saying this is not the right place to be. So first and foremost, what we need to do, deal with the issues that we're dealing with today, with wildfires and a forest that is burning down and burning up. What do we do to protect our communities? And how do we, what can we do to have forest policy and dealing with the future of the communities, especially if I look at France, Spain, you know, global warming is with us in a big way. So we have to pay attention to that. The second one is that there has to be coherence between First Nations, federal government, provincial government, and communities to first and foremost attract and maintain entrepreneurship. That's how it all starts. Entrepreneurs have ideas and can put things together that attracts capital. But there has to be an environment of in which we can do that. If we pay 45% in duties and still have between the United States and Canada and other places, no agreement, again on the 19th, we're going to add another 50% duties to other things, that it is obvious for anyone that is watching the news that the U.S. economy is not doing well. They're in desperate needs to build houses. There is no question in anybody that has knowledge that once they start building and single homes, about 1.5 million starts annually. Right now, we are somewhere around half that. If they start there, they are desperately in need for lumber products to build those houses with. They do not have it in the United States. They must rely on others, which likely is Canada. What then means that today's prices, because supply and demand sets price, that as long as we have still manufacturing capacity in North America that are not meeting the requirements or have more than the market requires, prices stay low. Once they start demanding, then the duties will be added to the price, and lumber prices that today may be around $500 or $600 a thousand board feet will go to $1,200. In my opinion, that's where we will be by next summer.
Interesting. I think that fills in the blanks that I had. Speaking with us in CIFA Radio Studios today is John Brink, owner proprietor of Brink Forest Products Group. And you've got a book on the way that is describing the forestry industry and
Right from the beginning,
everything we talked about today and more. If you want the nitty gritty, you can get it there.
Correct.
And thanks so much for spending the time to bring some context to the history of the forest industry and how you feel our present is shaping where you see things moving into the future.
For all those people watching us, I'm also a very active podcaster globally on different issues. Probably the most active individual podcaster in Canada. I've done 600 episodes. But I also do podcasts on the BC forest industry in crisis. And then the other thing that I do is I'm an author. I've written 5 books that show my way, starting from nothing to the dream of building my own company. And I'm still doing that today under adverse, sometimes, conditions.
Cheers to the next challenges ahead. And best of luck navigating whatever announcement comes on August 19th. Hopefully, you know, the winds are in your favor.
Yep. And I'll probably do another podcast here on the BC forest industry and crisis.
Friday the 14th.
Yeah. So that podcast I will do a solo and on the way that I do it here, kind of giving my opinions about what Trump is doing, why and how. I make that available globally.
Fantastic. Go on YouTube, search On the Brink.
With John A. Brink.
Perfect.
All Ian, right. It was a pleasure.
It was a pleasure as well. Yeah, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Absolutely. This is Ian Gregg reporting for CIFA Radio's Due North on 88.7 FM.
This initiative is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada through the Local Journalism Initiatives Program. Find our news stories online at frequencynews.ca or cfur.ca.